Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 25th, 2016, the Conundrum Edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson of Slate is here with me. Hello, John. Oh, you're with Face the Nation. I was just looking at your Slate and Face the Nation, but hello.
Hi.
Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine joins us from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello.
On this week's Gabfest, our special excellent show, our Conundrum Edition, would you rather be interviewed by 100 Dickerson-sized ducks or one duck-sized Dickerson? If you overheard Emily Bazelon telling a police officer her real name was Amelia Beazelstein, should you intervene and tell the cop that actually her name is Emily Bazelon? If I fought a panda to the death, who would you want to win? That's some of the conundrums we will not discuss on this show. But we will have real conundrums, the conundrums that you sent us, and we will also have more of them in the Slate Plus segment, bonus conundrums. And if you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get that by going to slate.com/gabfest. Plus, you sent in a ton of questions. So, this is a Dickerson special. You discover extremely humiliating personal information about a presidential candidate whose views you find repellent. This is from John from Maryland, by the way. In principle, you don't think the information is anyone's business. Do you leak it? Are you morally obligated to do it early enough that the candidate's political party, which you also find repellent, has a chance to nominate someone else? So you discover that a Trump-like character is a pedophile.
Well, that's a legal thing.
Yeah. All right. Something that's not illegal is just gross. He's a zoophile. He has sex
he's
with dogs.
And he's having an affair with his 20-year-old intern.
He's 15. He's having an affair with his 20-year-old intern. That's less. That's more
familiar.
Are you obliged to leak it?
You can't leak. You can't leak it. You got to either report it or not. That's the thing.
This is John from Maryland. May not be a reporter, so he's saying.
Oh, well, as a human, or as my job? Oh, I thought you meant
as a human.
Oh, well, for people who aren't journalists. Well, I mean, they can do whatever they want. They're not bound.
Okay.
Question's more interesting if we answer it as journalists.
Okay, as journalists.
Yeah, I think that's more the challenge.
Would you report on something which you don't believe to be news, but which the world believes to be news, and which would damage somebody who you want to be damaged?
I wouldn't do it because I wanted somebody to be damaged, because I would be...
Well, but would you perform that jujitsu that all reporters perform, which is like, it's news, it's the voters have a right to know?
That's a serious and important question, because... So what if this information came out and the candidate was only at 2% and not the front runner of a party, mm-hmm. right? So does that matter?
Do we get to take into account whether it's going to be good for our career to report the story? Because I'm going to confess that I'm sure I would think about that.
You would think about that, right, right. Yeah.
Huh.
Emily, would you report it?
I mean, I'm sure there is some middle ground, like could go either way scenario in which if I thought it was going to be good for my career, I would be more likely to do it, even though I would take a shower about that. I just feel like if I'm honest, there are ways in which it's super satisfying to have a juicy scoop. And when you're lucky enough to have that happen, and if people are going to pay attention to you, it's really tempting. And so I suppose, because I also think that, like, the public does often have a right to know, I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to say unless you know what the particular piece of information is. Because if I really felt like nobody did have a right to know, I hope that I would safeguard it. Hmm. David, what about you?
I I tend to think I would perform the that rationalization. I'd be like, well, I'm a reporter. Job of a reporter is basically to share relevant information. And I would twist myself in a pretzel to explain to myself why this was relevant information that people needed to know, even though if it were about me or if it were about my...
Or a candidate you liked.
A candidate I liked, I might... No, but I actually... I think I would be principled enough. I think I'd be principled enough that if it were a candidate I liked or a candidate I didn't like and it was it was morally damaging information and yet that I didn't think it really spoke against them, I think I would be willing to report it. I'm a careerist. I think Emily's point is a good one. I'm enough of a careerist that I would want the credit for that. I remember early on in the Clinton Lewinsky scandal, which I thought was total, it's a bullshit scandal. It's just ridiculous. There was a moment when Slate, we thought we were going to have access to the Linda Tripp tapes for complicated reasons. And I would have been delighted to publish the Linda Tripp tapes. Delighted if we'd been able to get that. Even though that was just a ridiculous waste of time, damaged the Republic, was bad for everybody. But I think I would have thought it was good for my career and good for Slate. John?
The relationship between the personal and private character and public office is, you know, we've been through kind of an up and down on that. I mean, it hurt Herman Cain's career, but in Herman Cain's case, there were two things involved. I mean, there were actual settlements of abuse, and so that was a legal matter. And it was also, at least in some of the cases, they were taking advantage of his relationship in the workplace. So that seems to me to be fair and in bounds. But if it's, I guess for me, it would matter whether it has had any relationship to the office. And I think there's a lot of personal stuff that doesn't have a relationship to the office. Or I should say, if we only elected the most pristine, morally upright people, we would shrink the pool of candidates to zero.
Yeah, but we all agree with that.
Yeah, you're making a news judgment about whether it's purient and it has nothing to do with the office and whether it has something to do with the office and people need to know it. Like, not all information about a candidate do people need to know.
So you're saying you would suppress it?
No, it depends. It depends on, like, is the candidate making a big claim about their...
Dickerson would suppress
news. Yeah. You know, is the candidate making a big moral claim about themselves relative to their opponents and their pristine moral character? If they're making it a part of the campaign, then that would matter because voters are being asked to make a judgment about that and they're being told a story and here's something that contradicts that story. But if it's like somebody running as a, you know, on some other story and some other set of facts, then this would seem to be less important.
Okay, next question. This is a totally different direction from Sean Toomey. Sean asks, would you rather be a dragon or own a dragon?
I want to be a dragon.
Forever?
That sounds so fun.
Is it forever? Yeah, or a day?
And are you in a dragon? Are you a dragon in, like, America right now? Or are you a dragon in Middle Earth?
I'm a dragon in Game of Thrones, for sure.
Yeah.
What does own mean? Do you have legal liability for the damage the dragon does?
Oh, my God. How can you answer in such a lawyerly fashion?
So if your dragon is, like, constantly eating the neighbor's cows, as the dragons on Game of Thrones are you being hauled into... Court.
Are you being dragooned in the court? There we go. Thank you, ladies
don't
and gentlemen.
Don't you have some better fantasy in which why your dragon
but why
is
would
like
you
out there?
That was
but
me high-fiving myself.
Why would you
myself?
Want to be a dragon? Why would you? A dragon is, it's
well,
a lizard.
Well, you get to fly,
it's a reptile.
First of all.
Yeah.
So what? You're super powerful. You burn things up with your tongue. You get to like
you
go
You do that every week, Emily.
Oh,
you
damn.
Have no dragon fantasy in you. You're just like moving into crabbed old legal liability. Like, come on. Where's your sense of an adventure? Didn't you read any fantasy books?
But do you have to be the dragon
forever?
The
dragons were the villains.
Do you have to be the dragon
I
forever?
I know. I'm being a villain. I'm enjoying in my imagination being a villain. I think it would be
But the
really
dragon
fun.
Is not the villain in its own
villain.
Mind. No. The dragon is not a villain in its own mind. The dragon
good
is...
Oh, God. You and your
yes,
villain
it's not...
not a villain
and
in its own mind.
And you could be a good dragon. You could be the dragon
Smaug
that, you
thought
know,
he was a
defeats
villain.
Defeats baby Hitler.
Smaug did not think he was a villain. He thought he was... He was rich. He was a collector of
jewels.
Jewels. He was a good tenant of the Lonely Mountain. He was fine. He wasn't like going out and doing a lot of damage
anyone.
All the time. He wasn't bothering
well, he
people.
Had done a fair amount
he's
of damage.
Kind of
yeah,
him.
We all have. He was in a healthy retirement. He was like, he was living in Switzerland. And it was fine. And then these people come along and harangue him and they want to.
You don't believe in
they
Nazi
have confiscatory,
hunting, apparently.
They have confiscatory taxation and they want to steal what he's earned. I think if I were an American billionaire.
Behavior.
Well, ill-gotten, schmill-gotten. He was anyway. But do you think? But so you if you were a dragon, you wouldn't feel you were evil. You would just feel like I'm being a dragon. A dragon does what a dragon does.
It's like some super huge expression of your id.
Unless you're Puff the Magic Dragon, in which case you're just a chill dragon.
You don't want to be a dragon, John.
I don't think I want to be a dragon. But I would like to have a dragon.
Okay, so you want to be an owner. What are you going to do with your dragon? Animals.
Good. Yeah, although it's really hard to train a dragon.
That was a good one. I like that. Next.
Me too.
From at Rue de Fortune. How serious of a crime would your mother or father have to commit before you turn them in?
Really serious.
Okay, we'll start at the top. You know, genocide.
Okay,
mass
genocide.
Murder. Mass murder, yes.
Yeah. Oh, easy.
Yeah. Murder.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, of course, that gets us back to, right, you know, what if it's murder of a person who's coming to kill your children?
Well,
yeah,
that's sort of a self-defense.
Right.
You would defend that, and you'd argue that in court. Dealing heroin to kids.
I don't think so. I mean, not that I'm in favor of such a thing, but there's, you know, family loyalty. I don't think that you report your parents for dealing heroin to kids.
Heroin.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, presumably, unless you can stop it. If there's no way to stop it.
John weaseling himself out of the question every time.
Are you then part of the criminal conspiracy? I wouldn't want to be in a situation where I'm going to have to serve time because my mom and pa are like carelessly, callously dealing drugs that I'm being implicated in.
I think unlikely if you don't live in their house that just the fact that you know about it, it'd be hard to prove that. So let's imagine there's no good chance of criminal liability for you.
Huh. Okay.
What if your parent is a dragon?
What about they've stolen from other people a huge amount of money? See, Emily would let them deal drugs, but she wouldn't let them steal.
Yeah, I don't know why that one bothers me more, because it's not like I think the dealing heroin is a good thing to be doing. But there's something about the victim is clearer to me, I suppose. That's the thing. Then I start thinking about the people who were defrauded and embezzled, and I feel guilty
about it.
Right,
Bernie Madoff. You're Bernie Madoff's kids.
I think you turn in Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, definitely.
Plus, now it's not my parents anymore we're talking about. That makes it easier. What about kids? Is this question any different if you're talking about your children? Do you protect your children against anything, or do you have the same rules?
That's harder.
I'm not. Oh, I refuse to discuss that. I'm not going to do that one. It makes me
too close to the bone.
It's too uncomfortable. I don't mind. I don't mind
speculating.
Because
your kids are committing genocide. They're not.
No, I don't mind speculating about my, you know, my 77-year-old parents.
I see.
What they might or might not do. But I just feel weird about doing it. Also, what if it's both of your parents? Would you turn them both in, or would you try to protect one?
No, that's weird.
That's not a kind
of... What about people who suspect their kids of terrorism and turn them in? That's happening.
Oh, not happening enough.
I'm always kind of impressed with those stories.
Yeah. It could have happened a little more in San Bernardino.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I read the interview with that dad who seemed to think that his son was talking a lot about ISIS and thought, you could have told someone about that.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. So a listener writes us, and I'm not going to use the listener's name because of the question. I'm an adjunct professor whose job depends on her classes being full enough to run. I teach science to business students. They either love my class because it's not business, or they hate it because it's not business. And if people don't sign up and enrollment drops, there goes my job. My conundrum, do I dumb down the course so these pissants get the grades they want? Or do I stay true to my profession, teach my subject, and they get the grade they deserve, risking, of course, the bad evaluations, loss of enrollment, and job? What should I do? What's an individual's responsibility in grade inflation? You're a teacher, Emily, so you have to grapple with this.
Yeah, grade inflation is a really hard one. It's a problem. It's everywhere. And then if you try to push back against it, it does come back to bite you. And you feel really churlish and grumpy, like you're the Grinch who stole Christmas. Grade inflation is a collective action problem. And I don't mean to let any individual person off the hook for it, but I think that the task of trying to address it individually is completely thankless. And for that reason, sort of unfair. So I really do think that the school has to figure out a way to help the teachers address it.
I agree. Oh,
that's brutal. Because really, I mean,
I think you give the pissants the grades they want. I agree with you, Emily. I don't think this is a problem that any individual can solve, especially one who does not have job protection. So it's different if you're a tenured professor. But if you're an adjunct somewhere, I don't think you owe the world super honest grading.
You're hurting your students by doing that because they're not getting the benefit of mistake making. And
well, that grade is not the teaching or the—
yeah, it's true. You could give them like crappy grades all the way along and then you give them a good grade at the end.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah.
Or, and right. Give them very vicious criticism that they need
that's
to work
good.
On.
That's a good— that's
probably the way to go.
That's the way to go. Yeah. Is to just really— and I actually don't mind that idea, which is basically like, if they're showing improvement, if they're showing the ability to respond and adapt to criticism, so that overall they haven't done so well, but you know, are showing improvement, then you could figure out a good grade at the end.
All right, Phil Goldstein, who is a classic GabFest friend listener, has a whole bunch of great questions. I'm going to do a couple of them. What is the best way to pass the time with an annoying seatmate on a plane, train, or bus? For this exercise, you cannot get off the vehicle and there are no other seats. Basically, you have to stay there.
So I'm really mean about this. I am afraid—
surprise—
to talk to people—
newsflash—
for almost the entire— I know, exactly. I bet you're sort of like this too. Actually, no, you are nicer. I think I've been on planes with you and you've been nicer, and I know John is nicer. I try really hard not to talk to people until the end because I'm afraid of the conversation continuing and going on and on. And if someone continues to insist on talking to me, I will almost rudely shut them down. But I recently had this experience where I was on the plane with an older woman and she didn't give up. And I finally just broke down and I ended up like showing her how to use her iPhone, which she completely didn't know how to use like at all. And I guess I was just entertained by the idea that she had this device and she had like— she didn't know how to turn it on. It was kind of fun. What do you guys do?
As I've gotten older, I engage less with people, but I haven't sat next to sort of a super insistent person for a really long time. I think people— maybe I ride the train a ton, but I don't know. People are not that forceful.
I got stuck in a conversation I couldn't get out of.
And you couldn't— did you say like, oh, I've really got to do some work now? And that didn't work?
I did all the nonverbal cues. And then part of it was my fault, or sections of it were my fault, because what this person was saying wasn't that interesting. And then they would say something that was actually really interesting, and I would ask a question about what they said, and then I'd like just reset the damn clock. Yeah. Here goes another 15 minutes of— so in the end, I blame myself.
There are really very few people in the world, vanishingly few people in the world, who if you give them all the nonverbal cues and then give them the verbal cues where you're like, oh, I wish we could talk more. I've really got to do some work. And you pull out your laptop, even if you don't, I've really got to finish this book, which I have to review. And you pull out the book, which you're not reviewing, that those people won't shut up.
Yeah.
And so
that's—
I guess
true.
I don't—
well, then
think
that's a good way to do it, right? Yeah. Just be— it's been so nice talking with—
yes—
you. I'm hoping to—
yes— it's been so nice talking to you. I've got this work I've got to do before we land in Buffalo.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output. bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Okay, another question from Phil. If you were able to live for a decade in one period from the past in a specific place, then return to the present, where would it be and why?
14th century Italy? 13th
no,
century Italy, maybe.
No, 14th or 15th, maybe. 15th.
15th,
Florence.
Sorry.
Yeah, you'd live in Florence.
Yeah.
But did you get to pick your station?
Oh, well, that's a good question.
Are you going to be some cleaning chamber pots, or are you getting to be...
Actually, and I don't even mean that, actually, now that I think about it.
Also, this question presumes that you don't die. You don't contract the illness that you would probably actually contract if you were.
Right.
15th century Florence is great. That's a really good one.
How about like ancient Egypt or the time of the Bible in Israel /
Palestine? Oh, I bet it would just, you'd be so disappointed. It would just be so pissant. You just would be shocked at how pissant it was.
Hmm.
Maybe Athens.
Ancient Japan. How about some like very
you'd have to be able to pick
advanced Japanese dynasty?
If you couldn't pick your station, you'd be screwed. In all the
I think that
right.
With all of these, you have to be rich or at least like not a slave, or else it's going to be just completely terrible.
I think a place where there's a huge amount of creativity and energy happening. What about
like Greenwich? You know, Greenwich Village in the 1950s and 60s.
That seems like a kind of lame answer, right? Like we're supposed to want to be around at a
time
when no one we know was alive.
Damn.
What about the Civil War or the Revolutionary War?
Yeah, Civil War was so much fun.
Yeah, if you didn't know you weren't going to die.
As a spectator, I mean,
having now
interested?
Seen Hamilton, isn't
well,
it
you
like,
know what?
Oh,
I think...
Hamilton, you know, Revolution, come on.
Well, I think the Civil War, I mean, think about it. Hundreds of thousands of people are dying in a really brutal way. I think you wouldn't want to watch that or be near that or know that was going on or have that in your nostrils because it would smell.
Also, do you get to know the outcome? If you get to know what's going to happen, it makes it easier because you can rationalize like, okay, I know we're going to win this battle and Gettysburg, good. That's going to go okay.
I don't think you get to know.
Yeah.
Do you guys read those Dan Gutman books with your kids where you get to go back in time with a baseball card, like back in time to FDR or the Black Sox scandal? I love those books.
No. I haven't read those.
No, they're really good. Jackie
you have to take
and me,
a baseball there's... card? I know. Oof.
Yeah, you have to take a baseball card and go. It's all very baseball player oriented. You have to hang out with Jackie Robinson or someone like that.
Sounds terrible. God. You have to go to baseball games.
Or what about Half Magic, that old Edward Eger book where they're going back to medieval or the Indian in the cupboard? Well, that's not really going back.
We were asked by many people to solve Baby Hitler. So would you go back in time to kill Baby Hitler?
Will you remind me, do you know who Baby Hitler is when you're killing Baby Hitler? Are you sure?
You're sent back to kill Baby Hitler.
And so you are on a mission and you think if this child grows up, he will turn into Hitler. I don't see why this is tough. I feel like, of course you kill baby Hitler.
John's killed.
I think you do too.
See, I guess, and there's no third option. The third option being like, you know that.
You send baby Hitler to Switzerland boarding school or something?
Yeah, or just that you know that any action that you take will change the path of history. Say, why? You don't even need to kill baby Hitler. Just like. You know, punch baby Hitler in the nose and it's different, or...
No, I think you stick to the bounds of the hypothetical.
The bounds of the hypothetical is you either can kill baby Hitler or... And
you kill baby Hitler or you let the Second World War happen? Why is that hard?
That's too easy. That's too easy.
Exactly. That's why I don't understand why it's really a conundrum.
Hmm. All right. That was easy. John Dickerson, can you be close friends with someone whose politics are different from yours? Without work, family, or a mutual friend tying you together? Asks Anne Leslie Nygaard.
For me, it's not that the politics isn't the problem. It's the behavior. There are people who have become more closed-minded in their treatment of others who don't share their points of view that I find that's not pleasant to be around them. It has nothing to do with whether they're on the right or the left. It has to do with their openness to my only ideology, which is that people should give other people a chance, be generous of point of view, walk a mile in the other person's shoes, treat others as you'd like to be treated, not be judgmental all the time as your first instinct, that kind of stuff. So that's my ideology that's more easily
like
trampled on.
That sounds more like being basically unpleasant as opposed to politically.
Well, but in politics, people can get unpleasant pretty fast. And some people, because I think we all know people who are incredibly ideological but are good people to be around. And there are other people for whom ideology creates a sourness of character.
I actually feel like it's important to have friends who are your ideological opposite, because you need to always try to understand where other people are coming from and remember that it's a real full human being, not just like Donald Trump on your TV screen.
Yeah. Parker Farrington asks, would you rather have a large budget to build your dream house or the same budget to travel the world?
World.
World.
That's easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's research supporting us, right? There was that great study about how experiences are what we should invest in.
Yes.
And looking forward to them is really important.
But if you look at actually how people live their lives, this is not how they live their lives.
No.
And actually,
true.
You know, and I will cite myself an example. We did a home renovation. We spent, you know, some ridiculous amount of money that we could afford to renovate our house. We could have spent that ridiculous amount of money to go take a trip, take a whole bunch of trips.
Do you think it was worth it? Your house looks nice.
Isn't that the question? I don't know. I mean, we spend a lot more time in our house than we do traveling the world. So maybe
it
makes
sense. Well,
and
you were changing the way, the configuration of the space in a way that was supposed to make it easier for your family to live in it comfortably.
I mean, that's not, it's not
you
exactly
just, like,
the same.
You weren't just like making it opulent.
Yeah, it's not well, a pure, it's not the pure pleasure.
Every single one of us in this room has spent significantly more money in the past 10 years on our house than we have on travel. I guarantee it.
Are you including the buying of the house? Because actually,
the buying the house is part of it. You could have bought a much less nice house and said, that'll be our travel budget. We all say this, and I certainly would have given the same answer. I do give the same answer that I would spend it on travel. But in fact, the way people live their lives is not what they say.
Well, so a couple things. One is that none of us has huge amounts of vacation time in which to travel. And we're all living in houses that are like comfortably, I would say, upper middle class, but there's nothing extravagant or lavish going on. They're not, right? They're in that band of like, okay, this is nice. This is contentment, but this isn't like the 1%. There's nothing ricochet, you know, there's nothing like super exciting or glamorous happening. Sorry, guys. I love your houses, but you know what I mean.
Okay, this is not a money conversation. This is a sex one. If you're single, which none of us is it ethical to go to bed with a married person?
No.
No.
David?
But the question, isn't the more challenging question, if you're single, would you?
Right. I know. That's what I was thinking. I don't think it's ethical.
I read the question. I'm thinking about it. That's Christian Hartzell asked this. Christian Hartzell, I hope you're not in a relationship. So the ethical violation is what? You're committing a crime against someone else's marriage.
Yeah, there's an injured party. There's a second injury.
But you can't possibly have, you're abetting an injury that the person you're sleeping with is causing.
Right.
But why are you,
you're literally
abetting it.
You're causing an injury too, because you're also causing an injury to the person who's being betrayed. You just don't owe them a duty of care.
Right. Rather than as being a human being.
Well, you don't owe them a duty of care.
Right.
You don't know what that person's relationship is. If someone came to you and said, I'm separated from my husband, my wife, he's abusive.
Right. Or just the relationship is falling apart.
The relationship is falling apart. I'm so lonely. I love you so much. You know, you're about to go back. You're moving away. Shouldn't we just see if we should be together? Or, you know, maybe this is right. And like, how is that?
Is Jennifer Aniston in this film?
I was hoping like that wasn't my choice.
No, I'm just saying, isn't she always in this film whatever?
I don't know why you're responsible for the state of that relationship.
But responsible is different from ethical.
If you have reason to believe that relationship is not in good shape, then is it okay?
I don't think it's in the abstract. I think it is unethical. When I have had friends come to me or having affairs with married people, I have not been sitting in judgment of them.
Yeah, but
also, why does this question matter if you're single? Isn't the question?
Well, because you don't have a burden.
Because you don't have your own marriage implicated in this.
Yeah.
Well, oh, I see. I don't know. You have a moral responsibility for what you can control, and you don't. Everyone else's marriage is an island. Like you have no idea what's going on.
But you are invading that island.
No, you're
it's
not.
Different
no,
to
it's
say,
the island.
I don't know what's happening, but to say like you have no control, of course you do, over your own actions, which are going to have an impact on this marriage.
Yeah,
you're affecting the climate of the island.
Right. You can say like this island was about to blow up anyway. I see the volcano on it. I'm like incidental, but I don't think you can say I have no control and no responsibility.
I mean, I don't think you should sleep with married people. I think that's a really bad habit. You shouldn't do it, but.
So where, what's
but
the
that, but
so
it, you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't do it because it's
bad
damaging
hygiene?
To yourself more than it's, I don't know.
Really? Like, that's your principal concern about it?
I don't
it?
Know.
Maybe
I
it
mean,
is damaging to yourself. Why do you know that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the damage that it would be to yourself is linked to
the... Why am I not as convinced about this as you guys are?
I want to know why you think it's damaging to yourself to sleep with someone who's married. There are people for whom those kinds of relationships, they want to be in a relationship that doesn't fully commit and that has this built-in... obstacle.
Exit ramp.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure where I am with this. Okay, you guys are right. Okay, fine.
We don't have to be right.
If you're having an affair with somebody and you have reason to believe that that person's marriage is troubled or gone or totally messed up, then why do you have to be the police person of that? Why are you responsible for protecting that marriage?
Well, assuming you could know all those things in certainty, then that changes the case. But you presumably
but you
in these kinds
would.
Of cases, you wouldn't really know that kind of stuff.
Well, so then you can then know.
Your best argument is that marriage is a dead and polluted institution, and why should we treat it differently?
Well,
from
I don't believe that part, unfortunately. Oh. I'm a big advocate of marriage.
That would have helped you. If you did believe it, that would have strengthened your hand.
It's just a social construct.
Yeah.
Hmm. Would you be willing to get the hiccups for 15 minutes every day for the rest of your life, but then be free of having any illness ever befall you in old age, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, etc.? So presumably, but I don't think you're allowed to get unlimited life. You just, I guess at some point you just drop dead, but you don't.
I think definitely you pick the hiccups in exchange for immortality.
Oh, really? I would not. Immortality
well,
is the worst.
You don't want to be immortal.
Who wants immortality? Okay. Immortality seems like terrible.
All right, let's go back.
Are
to
you
the
in
first
favor of immortality?
Not really.
No, not really.
Not unless
but
the people
I'm
could, in... I mean, unless I could grandfather some people in on immortality with me. You don't want to go sailing.
I'm sure you're thinking of us. We're at the very
the
top
Gab
of your
Fest
list.
Can you imagine it's Gab Fest? We're in year 1,000,000 of the Gab Fest.
And our Slate Plus today will be Emily's damn breakfast problem. Continues throughout the millennia.
In this century.
At that point, mankind will be fed by tube just as a way to get around right. having to hear about the breakfast right. dilemma.
Oh, my God. I can't even.
The hiccups for 15 minutes isn't so bad.
Every 15 minutes, I guess.
Couldn't
for
you
a minute.
Wait, every 15 minutes?
Oh, for 15 minutes every day? Oh, that'd be cake.
And what
God, I would take that just to like have a shorter commute to work, probably.
That's fine.
I guess you don't really hate the hiccups.
Well, they're not that pleasant, but it doesn't.
You have to be able to control when they happen, though. What if it was like at the most important, crucial time of every day when you were trying to have some, when you were pitching Atlas Obscura or something?
Huh.
That would be bad.
I would just wait 15 minutes, I guess. You would habituate to the unpleasantness of it, I think, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, John, would you take that?
Oh, hell yeah.
This is a good one. This is a really complicated one from Chris Burke. It's like 500 words long, but I read it and liked it. So he thought of this conundrum after visiting a European city with old and illustrious monuments, and he noted that all these monuments are filthy.
Oh, and, this is the one about the toothbrush.
Yeah. So there are three things you could do. One is you can just leave these monuments to be filthy, these profound, important, great triumphs of artistry, the Louvre facade. You can leave it alone. That's number one. It just gets dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. As my father describes, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Humphrey Bogart gets dirtier and dirtier and dirtier, and then he dies. But the Louvre would get dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. That's option one. Option two is you delicately clean the Louvre with toothbrushes and you protect these wonderful facades so that future generations will enjoy it down through the ages. And option number three is you take a pressure washer and you just pressure wash it, knowing that you're degrading it, ripping stuff off of it, causing it to shorten its life significantly, but you're making it really clean in the short term. And it's getting, you know, for those people who are going to see it in the next 10 years, damn, it's going to look good. And it will not take significant amounts of time, energy, resources.
Why is the toothbrush? I mean, the toothbrush.
The toothbrush is
it's expensive.
It's expensive. Takes a long time. That's what they did with the whatchamacallit, the Sistine Chapel. They basically toothbrushed it, right?
Yeah. Well, I think you do that. I think you do the toothbrush.
I think you do the toothbrush.
Really? Although, you know, I think you pressure wash it.
Yeah. Although, you know what you use to clean the Louvre with?
Toilet brush.
No. A loofah.
Oh. I was like the loo.
Sorry, Emily.
I think it's the preciousness around things is a bit much. I think in Japan, so these ancient temples in Japan, built in the, you know, 1,000 years ago, they're rebuilt every few years, every 40 years, let's say. They just get the same materials and maybe they do it piecemeal so that they'll do the roof in one decade. They'll rebuild the roof and then they'll rebuild all the statuary. It's in one sense, it's the same building, but nothing is original. It's just been reconstructed each time, year after year. Is that still a 1,000-year-old temple, or is it not a 1,000-year-old temple?
No, it's not. I mean, I'm the wrong person to ask about this. Because I really feel that connection to the ancestry and the time and the.
But why wouldn't you feel the connection
and
to the ancestry and time?
Toothbrushes.
It's being rebuilt.
Because
it's being
I'm
touched.
I'm a simple person, and I need the thing to
you,
actually.
You went to the
age.
University of Virginia. The University of Virginia. Every time I've been in the last 5 years, that stupid rotunda. It's every time I've ever been. Actually, that stupid rotunda has been under construction. They've been
right.
constructing it. There's no chance that thing is like
cleaning.
No, there's a lot of new stuff in there. But I mean, there's not. But there's still a lot of the original building and structure.
Why are
there.
You so impatient, David? What's more important? Like, why can't we have a few classical architecture masterpieces that we take very loving, tender care of?
I think, well, it's a few. I mean, I work for a place called Atlas Obscura, so obviously I recognize the value of wonderful old things in the world and strange things and preservation and the value of having things that have a history. But I also think there's a little bit of preciousness that creeps in. And not everything is worth preserving. And not everything that's worth preserving is not worth preserving forever. And everything that's worth preserving, you don't want to, you know, make too many people work on it. So
what if they're getting paid and there's a budget for it?
Yeah, but what if that budget was being spent on something else? Although, what better thing is there than art, I suppose? Maybe that's a good point. Like, no one's ever regretted having some beautiful object that survived for thousands of years. Everyone likes that.
That so many people get to enjoy. The Louvre is a public building. That seems like it matters.
Yeah. All right, toothbrush everything. Okay. That brings us to the end of our regular conundrum. The Slate Plus segment today, guys, is another conundrum. Is it okay to pee in the shower? So stick around for that. Our intern is L. Biscard Church. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Our email address is gabfest@slate.com. And subscribe to the GabFest in iTunes. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.